I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Last May, when Army Specialist Monica Brown was home on leave, she paid a special visit. She knocked on the door of a young soldier named Larry Spray. Just a month earlier, she'd saved his life in Afghanistan.
And I was wearing a dress, just like a summer dress, and he answered the door and he was like, "Brown, is that you?" He didn't really recognize me at first, so it almost brought me to tears, seeing that Spray was okay and, you know, he did get back.
Now, what Monica did to get Spray back has just won her the Army's third highest award for heroism, the Silver Star. It's a rare honor for any soldier. Monica is only the second female to receive the medal since World War II. She's 19 years old now, and she'll tell you that what she did last April has nothing to do with heroism. She was just doing her job as a soldier. I'm Aaron Henkin. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Last week, Vice President Dick Cheney was in Afghanistan to visit with U.S. troops and to help with the presentation of several awards, including the Silver Star.
I'm here on behalf of President Bush and the nation to say thank you. Thanks for serving our country, for doing it with such skill and honor, and making all of us very proud. The President and I get regular briefings on the action here, and we don't take you for granted for a single moment. We know the work is hard. We know the conditions are tough. We know the deployments are hard on families. But we're impressed beyond measure by all of the accomplishments that you've made. We've seen tactical skill and authentic American heroism, and I appreciate the chance to say to all of you, thank you for what you've done for all of us.
So without further ado, we'll begin the award process.
Attention to orders. The Silver Star is presented to Specialist Monica Brown for extraordinary heroism while serving as a combat medic on patrol on April 25th, 2007.
Monica Lynn Brown joined the Army because of her brother. Joining the Army was something he'd always dreamed of doing, and Monica wanted to support him. The two of them went together to the recruiter, and they didn't tell anyone else what they were doing.
The night that we joined, we came home, and my grandmother came in. We told her that she probably might want to sit down, and she asked us if we were in trouble. And we had never gotten into trouble before, but she's just worried because we were making her sit down and stuff. And then we said together that we had joined the Army, and she was like, "Oh." And she kind of paused for about 10 seconds and then said, "Well, I'm proud of you that you made this decision on your own." But I found out 2 weeks ago that she was actually kind of disappointed and scared, but she couldn't tell us kids that.
Just a few months later, Monica was on a plane to Afghanistan. She was a newly trained medic on her way to a combat zone.
I was pretty terrified because my NCOs had been here prior to me coming over here, and I'd heard a lot of different stories and scenarios of, you know, the situations they were put in. So I was kind of a little nervous. I didn't really know what to expect.
And tell me a little bit about your training as a medic. Why did you decide to become a medic?
I actually wanted to join as an X-ray technician, and they didn't have any open slots whenever I joined. I figured anything to get my foot in the door in the medical field would be, you know, one step forward than where I was at the time. And so I came in as a medic, and I was actually scared of blood whenever I first joined, but that ceased shortly after. I was in AIT for a while.
Monica's first job in Afghanistan was at a CASH, a combat support hospital, at Camp Salerno. After that experience, she started working as a line medic, going out on missions with convoys. On April 25th, 2007, she was part of an ordinary mission. Her combat team had gone out to a remote town to check on a house where a Taliban fighter was believed to be based. They searched his house and his cousin's house next door. They found nothing, but they could tell they'd aggravated the villagers with the intrusion.
So we left the town, and the local population wasn't really happy whenever we left because, you know, we were kind of loud whenever we were searching the houses, just disturbing the neighborhood, I guess. We were supposed to be heading back to the FOB that night, and we were on our way back out of the village. We got about, I guess, a mile or two outside of the village and turned left into a riverbed because we tried to avoid taking the roads because IEDs and stuff. And that's when the last vehicle, the convoy, got hit by an IED.
So you were actually driving off-road. You were driving in a riverbed?
Yes. Where the truck got hit was where the road meets the riverbed.
What happened next?
Grabbed my aid bag, and then we started receiving small arms fire. Then my platoon sergeant opened his door, and I opened mine, and he said, "Doc, let's go." And we ran back to the Humvee. the Humvee had caught on fire because the gas tank exploded, and the guys that were in the Humvee, there's five of them, were about 10 or 15 feet away. I saw that two of them were laying on their sides, but considering the firefight was still going on, we had to move them. We were up on high ground, and there was no cover for us anywhere. There was no trees, no rocks, no hills. It was just the riverbed and us, and so I had to move them to a different location to treat them.
The incoming enemy fire was a serious problem, but the danger was multiplied when ammunition inside the burning Humvee started exploding. Specialist Brown dragged the wounded soldiers behind enough cover to have a closer look at their injuries. That's when she saw that two of them were in particularly bad shape. Specialist Stanson Smith had deep lacerations on his head with blood running down his face. The other, Specialist Larry Spray, was severely burned.
He was over the gas tank whenever it exploded, and his foot was pinned, and Sergeant Tillier, who was in the seat in front of him, actually got out of the truck and helped him, like, pulled him out pretty much, and he ended up getting burned from it. But Spray had burns on the majority of his body, and after I cut all his clothes off to see how bad they really were and found out that they were pretty much everywhere. So I dressed with what I could, which was out of my aid bag, but I didn't expect to treat an entire body covered in burns. Pretty much all you can do in the field for burns is prevent shock, push fluids, and keep them clean the best you can, and then get them out of there. So that's what I did. Push morphine. And then I went over to Smith, the other guy that had lacerations on his head, and stopped the bleeding, got him dressed up, cleaned off his face, tried to keep him conscious the whole time, asking him questions, and he had burns on his hands as well, and shrapnel in his knee. So I addressed those.
And while you're doing all this treatment, what's going on around you?
The firefight was still going on. We were receiving incoming mortars. The burning Humvee was still kicking off the mortar rounds that were inside. There's a lot of commotion going on.
What was it like to try and do all this treatment with all these distractions around you?
I didn't really notice anything that was going on around me. I mean, I knew that there was sounds of bullets zipping by me, but I didn't think about it at the time. I just worried about the guys.
You were aware, though, that these guys were in danger of shells and shrapnel, because I think at one point you were covering them with your own body to protect them from shrapnel.
Yeah, but I think that's muscle memory, because that's what we're trained to do. Is when a patient's on the ground and I've stripped them of their IBA and clothing to find out how bad their injuries are, it's my duty to make sure that they're covered. I mean, I'm covered in my IBA, and he's wide open with no protection.
I'm Aaron Henkin. This is The Story. When Monica Brown's sergeant made his way back to where she was treating the injured, he saw what a precarious position she was in. He ducked away again, and when he came back, he was driving a small truck.
All it is a Ford single cab Ranger, non-armored. I think it may be lightly armored. And the bed in the back has like a bench in the middle from the other soldiers sitting in the back. And so it had been evacuated because the ANA soldiers dismounted to go suppress fire. So at the time, it was empty. So Sergeant Santos acquired the vehicle and backed it up as far as he could in the wadi. And then we dragged the patients over the vehicle, put Spray and Smith in the back, and then I jumped in the back, stomach down on the bench. That's probably the moment that I'll remember the most besides afterwards. And that's when Spray was up by the back window of the truck, and then Smith was to my right, and I was face down on the bench. And I was holding Spray's hand, and he was shaking because he was in a lot of pain from the burns all over his body. And the look in his eyes was just... I'll remember that forever because he was scared, but at the same time, I was holding Smith's forehead with my other hand trying to stop the bleeding because it was just pulling in the back of the truck, because the only way we could get him in there was face down. So I was holding Smith's forehead and holding Spray's hand with my other hand, and I was like, it's okay, we're going to be okay, we're going to get out of here. And then having Spray talk to Smith, and I was like, you know, Smith, tell me a story, tell me about your fiance, you know, talk to me, you know, tell me something, tell me a story. And so Spray was over there, and he's already in severe pain, and Spray's over there talking to Smith, you know, it's gonna be okay, we're gonna get out of here, you know, motivating him. And it's just to see a wounded soldier who's already in severe pain from burns trying to motivate and take care of another soldier is an emotional event for sure. I'll remember that forever.
So you guys were all sort of reassuring each other that it was going to be okay. Did you think these guys were going to be okay, or were you worried that you know, you might lose them at this point?
I didn't know about Smith at the time because he was going in and out of consciousness, and I didn't know what was going on with him internally. I actually found out later on he had a mild concussion. It wasn't bad, and then he actually had a lacerated spleen, so it's a good thing he got up to higher medical care because the infection could have killed him. But even though Spray had the majority of burns, I was more worried about Smith and, you know, where he was going with this, trying to keep him conscious and stuff like that. I didn't really know if everything was going to be okay. I was praying everything was going to be okay, but you never know.
The sergeant drove Monica and the injured soldiers, Stanson Smith and Larry Spray, to a spot further away from the ongoing firefight. They were sheltered now by the truck and a Humvee, and Monica continued to treat her patients. Mortar shells and bullets were impacting all around her, while nearby U.S. forces returned fire. She crouched over her patients' bodies to protect them from the hot shell casings that were flying through the air as fellow soldiers covered their position. Monica says concerns about her own safety never even entered her mind.
I had other things to worry about. Myself wasn't a topic that I was going through my head at the moment. I mean, yeah, I heard the mortars incoming and stuff like that, but it's all kind of a blur to me. I mean, I didn't really pay attention to it. I was more worried about, you know, what was going on with the guys and stuff like that. I didn't really think about myself at all.
And how about the standard and level of the care that you were giving? I mean, obviously you'd been through a lot of training exercises. You knew your stuff. You knew what you needed to do. But did you feel like your performance was hindered by your nerves at this point?
Not at all. Absolutely not at all. My emotions and my nerves didn't get in the way of this situation at all. Like I said, all I could think about was getting the guys out of there, and nothing hindered that the entire time.
Within the hour, a helicopter landed at the scene to medevac the injured men. As Monica Brown watched the chopper fly away, she had no idea if the care she had given would be enough to save the lives of her fellow soldiers. In a moment, we'll hear about the aftermath of the battle and an emotional visit here in the United States. I'm Aaron Henkin from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. U.S. Army Specialist Monica Brown has just won the Army's prestigious award for gallantry in action, the Silver Star. Vice President Dick Cheney presented her with the award personally last week in Afghanistan, while an Army representative recounted her heroism at a special ceremony.
While on patrol, the trail vehicle struck an IED, which ignited the fuel engulfing the vehicle in an intense fireball. The patrol began to take small arms and mortar fire. As the element returned fire, PFC Brown immediately dismounted her vehicle and, without regard for her personal safety, moved to the burning vehicle amid intense enemy fire. After arriving at the vehicle, PFC Brown began to treat two casualties. As she treated the wounded soldiers, intense enemy fire continued to impact her immediate vicinity. On several occasions, PFC Brown used her body to shield the casualties from enemy fire, as well as the explosions of ammunition. PFC Brown moved to the more protected position with her patients and continued treatment as enemy small arms fire continued to impact around her. Once again, PFC Brown shielded the wounded with her body. Specialist Brown's heroism and selfless devotion to duty reflect great credit upon herself, Task Force Fury, the Combined Joint Task Force 82, and the United States Army.
Monica says that eventful day last year was a life-changing experience for her and the other soldiers involved. But at the time, all she could think about was doing her job. The magnitude of what had happened didn't hit her until it was all over.
I was walking back from the medevac bird after I had briefed the flight medic on what was going on with the guys, and I just remember my headlamp was shining on the grass. The grass was about, I guess, mid-shin deep, and it was green. It was blowing in the wind as the medevac bird took off, and I just remember, you know, thinking, did I do everything right, and did that really just happen? And, you know, I think that's whenever it all hit me that it was a situation that I'm lucky to be alive right now from, so...
Yeah, I imagine there must have been a moment when you suddenly realized after the fact, I was really close to being killed myself.
Yeah, that was probably that moment whenever, you know, I was kind of in shock that I wasn't hurt and no one else got shot in the process because there were so many different rounds flying every which way that I'm surprised no one else got hurt. Someone was watching over us that day, that's for sure.
Now, at that point, you and the other soldiers who were there in the wake of all this that had just happened, like, what are you guys saying to each other? What kind of conversations are you having about what went down?
I walked back to the truck, and there was about four guys from the platoon just, like, smoking and joking, and then they walked up, and, like, they were hugging me and thanking me, and Bo Danny was one of the guys that was actually injured. He was burned from helping Smith away from the vehicle, and he was almost teared up because Spray and him were really, really close. And he was planning on getting married, and Spray was going to be his best man. It was a really emotional deal for him, and I just remember, you know, the intensity of how thankful they were. And
it must have been emotional for you, too, considering your role in everything that had just happened.
Yeah, after my adrenaline died down, I got a little sick to my stomach and stuff like that.
You know, and it seems like in a situation like this, you kind of go on autopilot as a human being, and you're following all this training and stuff, and then afterwards, when you've done everything you can, the emotions kind of come like a delayed reaction.
Yeah, I think so. I think that my training in every situation I had been through already kind of let me put aside the fact that they were my friends and, you know, what was going on with it. And other than the pain level, I mean, I understand that they were in a lot of pain during the entire process, but it kind of let me separate myself from the friendship that I have with them, and it let me actually do my job, and I'm thankful for that.
Last May, a month after the incident, Monica was on leave here in the U.S. She found out that one of the men she had treated, Specialist Larry Spray, had just gotten out of the hospital, and his home wasn't too far away from Monica. So she got in the car and went to his house for a visit.
And I was wearing a dress, just like a summer dress. And he answered the door and he was like, "Brown, is that you?" He didn't really recognize me at first. So I made fun of him and I said, "Oh my God, you're so clean." Because he was a gunner and he was always covered in like 2 inches of dirt. So it's the first time I've actually seen his face without dirt covering all over it. That was kind of funny. But then his mother was really emotional and crying and thanking me. And it almost brought me to tears to see her reaction and seeing that Spray was okay and, you know, he did get back and he was still alive and still able to walk and didn't have any other problems going on, so.
Well, how do you think this whole experience has changed you, Monica, having acted heroically in the way that you did?
I wouldn't call myself a hero by any means, and I don't think that I'm a different person because of it. I think that that was one of the first incidences where I was by myself to treat patients, and I'm glad that I had enough training and confidence in what I do to do it right. And I don't think that I'm a different person because of it. I know that I appreciate everyone I meet now, and I think that life is really a lot shorter than I thought it was, and I think that the medical field teaches you that life is just way too short.
Monica Brown was awarded the Silver Star last week for the actions she took to save the lives of her fellow soldiers in Afghanistan. Now, I mentioned earlier that the reason Monica joined the Army in the first place was because she was extremely close to her brother, Justin. They enlisted together in hopes of preserving that closeness. But ironically, they were sent to separate locations and hadn't seen each other since they were deployed. At Monica's awards ceremony at Bagram Air Base last week, she got a surprise. Her commanders had arranged for Justin to fly in for the occasion.
He walked into the room where the ceremony was held, and I saw Sergeant Major Farah, my battalion sergeant major. So I was going over to greet him, and then all of a sudden I see Justin all the way to the left of him, and I just ran up to him and started crying. It was kind of, I don't know, an emotional emotional event that was caught on camera, so I hope they don't show my weakness all over AFN and everywhere else.
What did your brother say to you when you saw him?
He was just like, "It's okay, it's okay." Because I was bawling like a big baby.
Now, the awards ceremony was sort of a whirlwind event for Monica, seeing her brother being surrounded by cameras, having her heroism acknowledged in front of a large audience. And when we spoke, I wondered whether, in all the commotion, Monica had the chance to talk to Vice President Dick Cheney, who presented her with the Silver Star.
During the ceremony, I didn't get to say anything to him other than thank you, Mr. Vice President, you know, the typical shaking hands and posing for a picture. But I actually got to sit next to him whenever we were eating dinner, and that's whenever I got to, like, have a one-on-one conversation with him. And, you know, he's a lot more laid back than I thought he would be.
I wonder if he mentioned at any point about this whole notion of women in combat and then changing nature of this close quarters combat and this new kind of combat and the idea of combat pay for women.
He didn't mention that, no.
I wonder if you've thought about that. I mean, obviously, you know, you ended up in an extremely hazardous combat situation.
I think that gender has nothing to do with it. I think that a soldier is a soldier no matter what kind of situation they're put in.
So, overall, it sounds like the experience of getting this medal was, it was rewarding on some level, but I wonder how it compares to, you know, the reward that you had when you got to go on leave and see one of your fellow soldiers that you saved.
If I could take back this entire situation and have everyone back to normal and, you know, take away the scars and take away, you know, the situation and all the pain that they had to go through, I would in a heartbeat. Nothing's more rewarding than seeing the guys are okay. But, I mean, I would take back this, you know, not get this award and see that everyone's normal and didn't have to go through all of this.
And how is Smith at this point?
Smith is good. He's back with his unit. He's got a scar on his eyebrow from what I heard, but he's doing good.
Well, Specialist Brown, thanks very much. Congratulations, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
We spoke with Specialist Monica Lynn Brown from Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Last week, she was presented with the Silver Star Medal for Gallantry in Action. She'll soon take a break from the armed forces and go to college. When she comes out, she'll put her uniform back on, this time as an officer with a Silver Star. We have pictures at our website, thestory.org. Now, our next story is also one that takes place during wartime, World War II. Close your eyes and imagine this. The dark pine woods of the Hürtchen Forest. It's a series of hills on the border between Belgium and Germany. It's late in the Second World War. After the Allies had stormed the beach at Normandy and the Germans seemed like they were on the run, thousands of American soldiers were sent after them into the forest. The going was slow, and it seemed like the shelling never stopped. It was to become the longest single battle ever fought by the U.S. Army. For three long winter months, Allied forces fought through row after row of fortified German machine gun posts. The German army could see the war turning in the Allies' favor, and in desperation, they fired off every conceivable kind of artillery at the Americans in the woods. By February, in the winter of 1945, there were 24,000 U.S. casualties. Now that's the backdrop. What comes next tells of one American soldier's class ring, lost somewhere in that forest. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And this story starts with an email from Marshall Anderson. Marshall wrote to say, "My dad lost his college ring at the Battle of Hürtchen Forest in Germany in November 1944. The day after losing the ring, he was wounded. He told me the story many times about losing the ring. He passed away in 2001. Now, before we go any further, it's worth knowing how much this class ring meant to Marshall's father. Marshall explained when he spoke with the story's Dick Gordon.
He was the first person in his family to go to college, and he had to work his way through college. And when he graduated, he didn't have enough money to get the ring. And so he had to wait quite a few years to get the ring. And he got it either about 1939 or 40. He was a class of 34.
Right.
At that time, he was working with a civilian. He was in the Army, but he was working with a civilian conservation corps, the CCC.
Yeah.
And then when war broke out, he was then went into the Army in active service.
So I suspect this 5-year wait of his kind of increased his anticipation. The ring perhaps meant a lot more to him than students who would pick it up in 34, right?
I always gathered that impression. And of the very few stories he would ever tell me about his experiences in the war, he always told his story about the ring. And somebody asked me the other day, did he ever embellish the story? Did it ever, you know, get bigger and bigger the more he told it? No, he always told it the same exact way.
Do you remember it well enough to tell it as he would tell it?
Yeah, yeah. He said that he was in this area about 20 or so miles inside Germany called the Herzen Forest. It was in November of 1944. He was a first lieutenant in the service in the 28th Division, and he was ahead of a platoon that were forward artillery spotters. So he was actually behind German lines. This was part of the Siegfried Line. And he and his squad or platoon had dug foxholes. He was trying to fortify his foxhole with some limbs, branches of trees around the area. And as he was doing this, all of a sudden the Germans started shelling the area quite heavily. And he said, I dove for the foxhole, and I realized that this piece of wood I had in my hand, I had to get rid of because I might fall on it and break a rib or something. So he said, as I was diving for the foxhole, I just flung the piece of wood into the air, and a branch from that piece of wood caught his ring, yanked it off his finger, and he says, I can see this ring flying through the air. And the only thing I could think of is I'm going to die. So he hit the bottom of the foxhole and covered himself up as best he could. And the Germans continued shelling for maybe 30 or so minutes. And he said, when the shelling was over, he looked around and the place was just completely pulverized. There was nothing recognizable. The trees were shattered. Everything was awful. He says, I looked around as best I could, but I could never find the ring. It might have been buried or something. And he always said, you know, I wish I could go back because I know exactly where it was in the forest. And if I could just go back there, maybe I could find that ring.
He missed that ring then.
He really did. He really did.
But that's not the end of what happened to him in the forest at that time.
Right. Right. The next day, and I'm not sure if I never got this part of the story straight, so I don't know if he was actually in the same place or he was a different place in the forest. But anyway, again, he was out trying to fortify his foxhole. This time the Germans started shelling again, and he said a round hit in a tree maybe 20 feet from him, and all of a sudden he felt this awful pain in his right leg, and a piece of shrapnel had torn through the upper part of the leg. He also was hit in the back, although he didn't know that till later. So there was another person who was wounded in the foot that was part of his group. They needed to get both of them back to an aid station, but they couldn't spare any of their troops. They had captured some Germans, and my dad said one of them actually spoke quite good English because he was from New York. He'd grown up in New York. So these couple of prisoners took the two Americans who were wounded back through the German lines to the aid station.
Carrying them or?
Well, they had to kind of support my dad because he couldn't put any weight on his leg.
Yeah.
And my dad said several times the Germans would actually start shelling again. And when they did, the German prisoners would put the Americans on the ground and lie on top of them to protect them.
Because they were told to do that, or just because that was a decent thing to do?
I think it was because it was a decent thing to do. My dad, like I say, never told many stories about the war, but he did tell me on one or more occasions that anytime they captured German soldiers, that the soldiers were really upset with what their country had done. They hated the war. They hated Hitler. They didn't want to be in the army. They didn't want to fight.
This was 1944. Everybody knew which way the war was going at this point, right?
Right, right, right. Everybody except for probably Hitler, right? But anyway, so these German prisoners, I assume, felt it was their duty to do that.
So your dad is being supported and helped out by these German prisoners. He gets to an Allied aid station, and he's okay?
Right. Right. They treat his wounds, and they determine that the war for him is over. So he's sent back to England, and then from there goes on a troop ship back to the U.S. And he first saw me. I was born early in January, and he first saw me like 12 days after I was born. Huh. Finally made it back to my mom and I in South Carolina.
Marshall's dad made it back to his infant son and his wife, and believe it or not, the class ring also made its way back home. We'll hear how in just a moment. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In November of 1944, an American soldier by the name of William Anderson was fighting in the Battle of Hürtchen Forest on the border between Belgium and Germany. While scrambling into a foxhole, he lost his ring, a class ring. On it was his name and Wofford College, class of 34. William died without ever again seeing that ring that meant so much to him. When William's son Marshall spoke with Dick Gordon, he talked about hearing his dad's story of the ring, but he says he rarely heard any other stories about his father's time in the war.
He was very reluctant to tell what had happened to him and what he'd experienced in the war. Only occasionally would he say a few things, and he would always catch himself and stop. My mother did tell me that, you know, he suffered greatly when he got back, that he had been under such fire, because he landed at Omaha Beach and he fought his way through France and Belgium and into Germany, so he'd been practically constantly in battle.
Yeah.
And my mom would say anytime there was a loud noise, he would immediately dive for the floor. If there was thunder and lightning, he would hide under the bed, and sometimes just he would wake up in the middle of the night screaming. So I guess today we'd call that post-traumatic stress disorder, I guess.
Shell
but
shock
it actually
was the
happened
word.
To people. Yeah, or shell yeah. shock was what it was called back then. But he definitely suffered from it. And he was so against war and violence still. When I was a kid, he would tell me now, you know, all kids love to play cowboys and Indians and things like that. And he was very much against that. He says, you don't even point your finger, you know, at someone. He just didn't believe in that sort of thing.
And he was serious. He wasn't just fooling
he
around.
He was very serious, yes.
But he told the story of the ring, and he told it often.
Yeah. I probably heard it maybe 8 or 10 times.
Yeah.
And like I say, always exactly the same. It was like he was reliving that situation in his mind's eye. You'd see him kind of look up at the ceiling when he told it. And, you know, he would animate it by throwing his arm up in the air and saying, I could see the ring flying off. And I knew that I may never see it again.
Marshall's father never did see his class ring again. He died in April of 2001 at the age of 90. But the story of the ring lived on. One day, more than 4 years after his father's death, Marshall got a telephone call.
It was in early June of 2005. I had come home from work, and I saw the little light blinking on the answering machine. And when I played the message back, it was from a person, Charlie Gray, at the alumni office at Wofford College. And he said, give me a call, and gave me the number, and says, we think we found your dad's class ring. Of course, my first impression about that was, yeah, sure. My dad lost his ring in World War II in a battle in Germany. There's no way in the world.
Did you think it was a bad joke, maybe?
I kind of thought, but then I kept thinking, well, who at the college would know my dad lost his ring, you know? So there's got to be something to that. And that's actually what made me pick up the phone the next morning and call. And so Charlie says, yeah, a person in Germany has it. And that kind of made me raise my eyebrows.
Now you knew something was up.
Mm-hmm. And he said, your dad was in World War II. And I says, yeah. And he was in the Battle of Hurricane Forest. I said, yes, he was. He says, well, this young man has your dad's ring, and it has his name engraved on the inside.
So the ring itself would have had your father's name.
Yeah, William M. Anderson, yeah.
And the college, and that's it.
Well, it also had the date. It had 1934, the date of his class.
Okay, right.
Now, the story gets a little convoluted from there.
Now, that's because it turns out the ring had not just been found in the forest. An old man in Germany had actually been wearing it. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Marshall's contact turned out to be a man in Germany by the name of Michael Schumacher.
What had happened was Michael Schumacher, the guy who had the ring, his grandmother had died fairly recently. His grandmother and grandfather were walking at the edge of the forest one day, and actually Michael's mother was with them. But according to Michael, he thinks it's his grandmother that actually first spotted the ring
right.
and reached down and picked it up. The field had just been plowed. As Michael was going through some of her effects, he found the ring, and he'd seen it when he was a kid, and he'd heard stories about it. And Michael had his grandfather's drawing of the ring. He drew pictures of the outside and the inside of the ring with my father's engraving of his name in the inside of the ring. And this is what he passed on to the American Red Cross to try to find the owner of the ring.
Right, I got you.
And so Michael decided to make one more attempt to find the owner. So he was an aficionado of this battle. He said he read all kinds of books and everything he could get his hands on about the Battle of the Hurricane Forest.
Had he had family in that battle? Do you know?
Well, I don't think so.
Okay, just curiosity.
He's never mentioned that. Yeah. He's never mentioned that, so I don't think so. But there was an electronic bulletin board about the battle, and so he posted information about the ring. A woman in Hawaii happened to be looking on that electronic bulletin board. She was looking for information about her uncle, who was in the battle and had died from his wounds.
Yeah.
And she saw the posting by Michael with his email address. And so she emailed him and asked for more information. Now, Michael's apparently a very good photographer because he'd taken all kinds of pictures of the ring. So he emailed this woman in Hawaii the pictures of the ring. And she began to look at them. And she could clearly see the name of the college, Wofford College.
Yeah.
She could see my dad's name. And she could see the year, although it was a little obscured, and she thought it was 1939. So I guess that's when she started doing a search, and she found the college, and she contacted somebody at the alumni office at the college by email, gave them the information, and said, do you have a William M. Anderson class of 1939? And they emailed back and said, no, we don't have one of 1939. We have a graduate from 1934 by that name. So then she contacted Michael again and gave him the information. And then he contacted the person at the alumni office and I guess sent him pictures of the ring because the guy at the alumni office, Charlie Gray, said, yeah, I've seen pictures of the ring. This is your father's class ring, for sure. So after talking to Charlie, he contacted Michael. And that afternoon, Michael emailed me and I had pictures of the ring. I had pictures of Michael. I had a picture of a map of the area showing the gate and the field, you know, right next to it.
And does Michael speak English? Were you guys able to communicate?
His written English is not very good.
Right.
And I've never spoken to him, so I don't know. But I'd obviously love to go there sometime and meet him and tour the place.
How much was he able to tell you about the history of the ring? I mean, if it had been in his in some effects that he'd found, when was it actually plucked from a field?
He said that he thought it was plucked from the field sometime in the 1950s. And actually, that's kind of corroborated by the fact that he sent me the picture of these drawings that his grandfather did of the ring. And there's a date that his grandfather scribbled on this that says August 1958.
Huh.
He said that his grandfather, you know, they never sold the ring. You know, they found all kinds of other artifacts about from the battle that they would sell because, you know, people in that area were apparently very poor. But his grandfather obviously never sold the ring. And he says, as a matter of fact, it was one of his grandfather's prized possessions after he tried and tried and tried to find the owner, that on special occasions, his grandfather was actually wear the ring.
How interesting.
So I thought that was really neat.
Yeah. Yeah. So did he agree to send it to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was very anxious to get it back to its rightful owner, and in case, the son of the heir of the rightful owner. So within about 2 or 3 weeks, maybe, at the most, of first hearing from him, a package arrived in the mail, and there was the ring.
How had he packed it up?
Very, very carefully. It was wrapped in cloth and then put in a box, like a jewelry case box, mm-hmm. and then that was put in a package. And apparently it cost quite a bit of money to send it.
Why, had he insured it as well, I bet?
Yes. So I made sure that I sent him a check for all the money he had spent on sending the ring, because I didn't want him to have to bear the cost for that. He was quite surprised by that, but, you know, that's just the way I am.
Marshall, what was it like for you, though, unwrapping that cloth and the little box and seeing
my
this
hands,
ring that had been, like, so much a part of family history?
My hands were just shaking. I almost dropped the box twice. It really was something.
When you first held that ring, I mean, did you look at it for marks or scratches? I'd have gone straight for that. You know, did the branch mark it when it pulled off his finger, that sort of thing?
There were some scratches on the ring. It obviously looked like it was not, you know, brand new out of the box. It had some scuffs and scratches on it, especially on the bottom of the ring. There was no scratches on the stone that I remember. Actually, I've got a picture here. Let me take a look. No scratches on the stone, but the bottom of the ring, where you're looking on the inside.
Right, which is the part where you would scratch a ring that you wear like that. Yeah?
Right. It has a couple of scratches on it, and maybe, I hadn't even thought about that, now that you mention it. Maybe that's where the branch scratched the ring as it pulled it off his finger.
Because that would have had to have been a fairly violent yank, right? I mean, any ring that you wear, you think about how difficult it is to pull it off.
Right. Now, whether my dad, you know, might have been sweating at the time, although it was cold.
November, yeah.
November, and that was a very, very rough winter in Europe because, you know, after the Battle of the Herchin Forest was the Battle of the Bulge. And it was very cold. And my dad talked about how cold it was and how every night it was just freezing cold. And you'd wake up in the morning covered with snow. And
now, we have to just guess at this, Marshall, but the ring likely sat in the dirt of that field for 10, 15 years. We don't really know.
Yeah.
Any signs of deterioration or wear for that?
Not that I could tell.
Huh.
It just looks like the normal wear and tear on a ring, you know. And there's another interesting thing about the ring, too. When my dad got the ring, the company that made it, and I don't know what company that is because there's no markings on the ring to see what it is. The company, the stone in the ring is supposed to be a black onyx. And at that time, because of the war, they couldn't get the stone. So they put something else in the ring. It's just a black plastic or whatever.
Yeah.
And apparently my dad said that they gave him a certificate that's saying, in the event that they were able to obtain the black onyx, they would notify him and he could send the ring in and they would replace the stone with the black onyx. Well, it's still got the piece of rubber or plastic or whatever's in there.
What does it mean to you now? What kind of a, I don't know, connection, what kind of an emotional connection does that ring provide you back to that time in your dad's life?
Well, you know, every time I look at the ring, the one thing I think of is the sacrifices that my dad and his generation made, you know, so that our generation could live in peace.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Now, after hearing this saga, Dick asked Marshall what he planned to do with this ring that his dad had lost so long ago during World War II.
My plans for the ring are maybe a little odd, though. What I really want to do with the ring, because I've got pictures of it and I've held it in my hands for all these, you know, for these 2 years and everything. But what I want to do is to give it back to people who can understand something about the story. So what I've been trying to do is to make a presentation box with the ring, with the story about the ring, with the pictures of the forest and the field, Michael's grandparents,
yeah.
The map of the area, and the flag that draped my dad's coffin when he died, and to present this to Wofford College to display in their alumni hall.
You're willing to let this ring go. You're willing to... I mean, I like the idea of the presentation box and sharing the story, don't get me wrong, but yeah. There'd be a part of me that would want that ring to be close by.
Yeah, but I think he would have wanted it shared. I just kind of get the impression that my dad was the kind of person that he would have wanted it shared, and especially with his college, because it was his college ring, and he really was close to his college. He really... you know, always talk so fondly about it.
It's too bad, you know, that ring, if the German family had been able to find you 4 or 5 years earlier, your dad would have been alive to know that the ring had been found.
Right. Although by that time he was suffering from dementia.
Yeah.
So I'm not, although, you know, even with that, perhaps seeing it,
holding it,
would have really sparked the memories. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My one regret is that he didn't live to see his ring again. And that's a shame, but, you know. And when I saw it, of course, it was all new to me because this was something I'd heard about from my childhood, but I'd never seen.
I just find this story gives me a chill, this notion that something as small as a ring would be lost in something as wild as that battle and would find its way back to you. It's like something out of a Tolkien novel, it really is.
I know. The ring.
Well, keep us up to date on this, Marshall. Tell us where the ring winds up, we'd like to know.
I sure will.
Marshall Anderson lives in Crown Point, Indiana. Marshall hopes to retire next year, and he's planning a trip so he can walk through the field where his dad's ring was found and see the forest with his own eyes. Now, since this story first aired, Marshall has moved ahead on his plan to donate the ring to Wofford College. It'll be in a special display in the alumni building, along with the flag from his dad's casket. There's a photo of Marshall and a picture of his father's class ring at our website. We're at the story. .org. Now, that's also where you'll find a button you can click to contact us with your favorite lost and found story. Even if it doesn't have the epic grandeur of a Tolkien adventure, we'd still love to hear it. Here's the website again, thestory.org. You can also call and leave us a message at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or you can write to us at The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 27517. And that zip code again, 27517. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.